space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Larry Mueller Show as we talk about the stars with our guests today. We got a couple for you. With me in the studio, Jim Lattice, director of the University of Wisconsin Space Place, faculty associate in astronomy at UW-Madison. Jim, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here again.
And with us by phone today, John Rummel. John's a lifelong amateur astronomer and a photographer and a longtime member and past president of the Madison Astronomical Society. And John's also a member of the International Dark Sky Association. He's an activist for smart lighting and protecting the night. John Rummel, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Well, I tell you what, we got lots to talk about. You know, this time, I love this time of the year for looking into the skies. It seems, Jim, it seems like it's brighter out there.
Well, it can be. Yeah, we certainly have often nice, clear. Well, yeah. We do have clear skies. It's been cloudy, it seems like, for 2 weeks. But yeah, you get some nice dark nights. And it's brighter literally in the sense that we have more bright stars in the winter sky than we do any other time of year. All the well-known constellations like Orion, that whole grouping of winter stars up there makes for really great stargazing this time of year.
Yeah, I'm one of these. I'm usually early morning before light is when I'm out there because I'm doing my jog, my 3 miles in the morning around 5:30 or so.
You're already seeing the springtime sky then.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm enjoying it, and I've got my little app. If I'm missing something, I pull my phone out and click on that app, which name I can never remember. I don't know why.
There are several really good ones out there,
and it has some weird some space-like music that'll play.
I think you can turn that off.
I got to figure out how to turn that off. Once in a while, I've sort of butt-dialed it, and suddenly there's this music, and I'm wondering, is this it for me? Oh, my gosh. And the winter sky is, Jim, it's a lot different from the summer sky or the spring sky.
Sure. Yeah. And you were usually, when we're talking about that, we're usually talking about the evening sky. That's what, unlike your pattern, most people are out stargazing in the evenings. And so there's this time of year. Although this varies, of course, where the planets are going to be, they don't move on an annual cycle, of course. But these evenings, these winter evenings, we've got three major planets in the evening sky. As soon as the sun goes down, Mars, Jupiter, going west to east, Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars, and then we have now Venus rising into the evening sky. We had Mercury a little while ago, so we actually had all five major planets for just a little while, although Mercury's always a challenge to see, so that was kind of a theoretical construct. But Mercury will be good again in April, although we'll have lost Saturn by then. But so lots going on in the evening sky with planets and then all kinds of things for But even simple instruments like binoculars or something are great for stargazing, and there's a lot of great binocular objects in the evening winter sky, too.
Yeah, I was thinking March. Venus and Jupiter kind of line up. They're a long ways away, but don't they kind of line up for us?
Yeah, they'll come pretty close together in the sky. Yeah, so there's going to be a close approach of Venus and it's coming up really fast. There's going to be a close approach of Venus and Saturn here on the 22nd of this month. But then, 1st of March, we get Venus and Jupiter. So what's really happening is Venus is kind of catching up with both of those objects, and they're working their way over into the into the western twilight. So first Venus will catch up with Saturn, they'll be close together, and then it'll catch up with Jupiter, and they'll be close together. So those are great opportunities also for binocular viewing. Don't need a telescope or anything.
They look close together, but they're...
look close together, they're pretty far apart. Yeah, they're just in the same direction in the sky. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, John, Let me turn to you for just a minute. There's some recent news is that Madison's Common Council voted to apply for dark sky community status from the International Dark Sky Association. What does that mean to be a dark sky community?
So there is, this organization that you mentioned, the International Dark Sky Association, has been around for many years, and they obviously promote sensible lighting, smart lighting, trying to decrease the explosion of light pollution that has diminished the enjoyment of the sky for so many people worldwide, yeah. And certainly in this country. And, some years ago, I'm not sure exactly how long ago, maybe 10 to 15 years ago, the International Dark Sky Association developed this program to encourage communities to practice better night lighting, practices, limiting wasteful light mostly. And by wasteful, for the most part, we're talking about poorly designed lights that spill much of their light up into the sky where it does nobody any good at all. When we use lighting, we're obviously trying to illuminate the areas and surfaces that are important to us for safety reasons and for security in our homes and parking lots and things like that. But many of the light fixtures are just so poorly designed that they spill, upwards, even as close to 50% of their light needlessly up to illuminate the bottoms of clouds and airplanes, yeah, and the bellies of birds and things like that. So IDA has this program called Dark Sky Communities where they work with communities and encourage local authorities to develop lighting ordinances and building codes that encourage the use of smart lighting. And if communities meet certain guidelines, and those guidelines can be fairly intimidating and extensive, but if communities, show significant progress toward meeting those guidelines and a commitment in the future to meeting those guidelines, they can earn what's called this dark sky community status. There are, I didn't look up the number, but I think there are currently 50 to 80 jurisdictions in the United States that have that dark sky status. A lot of them are state parks, national parks. There are some towns on that list, but most of the towns are on the smaller side. Silver Cliff, Colorado is an example, some small towns in Utah. Mm-hmm. If successful, Madison's bid to get on that list would make Madison by far the largest community ever to do it. It's not an easy task. The Common Council has voted to approve that resolution, as you noted, and now it goes over to the city administration, basically to put this into practice and to make it happen. And they've got a very, very large task in front of them. It could be a years-long task, but it's very, very exciting that the city is moving in this direction.
It sounds exciting, and, in the end, it's probably going to be better for everybody.
It's hard to imagine a downside to this. I mean, it reduces energy consumption because you don't need as much energy going into the lighting if you put it only where you need it instead of wasting it off into the sky, and certainly be great for stargazers. It's always a challenge to do astronomy education when the sky is brightly lighted, so it'll be great for us.
So what are the things that you're looking most forward to getting your binoculars or your you've got a great telescope, Jim. you've got one of the best. I've looked through that baby. It is really something. So what are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to slightly warmer weather,
yeah,
and slightly clearer weather. So there's going to be some really nice planet viewing as we go forward into the fall. As soon as Venus gets nice and high up into the evening sky, and even a small telescope will show you this. We're going to see its shape change. Venus is the really the only planet that you can see go through phases like the phases of the moon. Right now, if you were to get a look at it in a telescope, it would look like almost like a full disk, although maybe a little bit more like a gibbous moon missing a little bit from one side. But it's coming around in its orbit towards us from the far side of the sun in towards us. So as it gets further off to the east, it's higher in the sky. And watching the phases of Venus change as it gets bigger and changes to a dichotomy and then a crescent, that's going to be fun in the spring.
Venus, something to watch for. And I tell you what, we're going to give you a lot more to look for in the sky. And we're also going to talk about photography as it relates to that, because John's done a lot of what they call astrophotography, right? Astrophotography. And we'll be doing that right after we take a quick look at the news. You can join in right now if you want. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Oh, we're taking a look at winter stargazing and astrophotography on the show right now. Larry Mueller here with two guests, John Rummel with me by phone. He's a lifelong amateur astronomer, photographer, longtime member and past president of the Madison Astronomical Society. Jim Lattice with us as well. Jim directs the University of Wisconsin Space Place and is a faculty associate in astronomy at UW-Madison. So questions about the night sky or questions about maybe taking some photos of the night sky? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@WPR.org. Jim, we always talk about this, and I forgot to mention it as we started, but what's going on at Space Place? I know there's always a lot of things going on.
Sure. We probably ought to mention specifically our public programs that we have for the general public, which include on the on the second Tuesday of every month, so next month, February 14th, actually. We'll have a guest speaker, and that should be really interesting. We're going to have a guest speaker who's a researcher on campus on the origins of life, and with reference to origins of life on, you know, other planets and things like that. So we always have some fascinating guest speaker on the second Tuesday of each month at 7 p.m. And we also live stream those onto our YouTube channel, which you can find on YouTube at UW Space Place, of course. We also have talk about the sky. If the kind of things we're talking about today are of interest, I give a talk every third Friday on what's currently happening, current events happening in the sky. That's also at 7 p.m. And then Saturday mornings, every Saturday morning, my colleague Kay Krewald does a Science Saturday program at 10 on Saturdays at Space Place, which is at 2300 South Park Street.
It's a cool place to watch. I mean, the arena there that you work out of is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a great location, and we have a nice exhibit area as well as the activities and the lecture series and things like that. The other big public outreach thing that the UW Astronomy Department does this time of year, in the summer we do a program called Universe in the Park, but that we need the summer to come along for that. Washburn Observatory, a lot of people will know that we haven't been able to do our public nights. The tradition in the astronomy department since 1881 is to open to the public at the observatory on the first and third Wednesday nights of each month. And there's been mechanical work, not on the telescope, but on the dome that houses the telescope, which is still going on. So we can't have our normal public Wednesdays, but that should be fixed in the spring. I don't have a date right now for that, but we hope to go back to our public nights on the first and third Wednesdays sometime this spring, hopefully sooner than later.
And those are great as well. Alan in Dubuque, Iowa's got something for us. Let's go there. Alan, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much, and thank your guests, too. So I'm director of our little gallery at the University of Dubuque. And like most people, I've always been enthralled when I see, and it's just, you know, the odd space picture, the colors, the lights, the composition. So I'm wondering, does either the university or the maybe the Madison Astronomical Society, do you have an exhibit or do you have people who take photos that would be willing to exhibit works in an art gallery?
That's for John.
Yeah, I was turning that one over to John. John Romo, what do you think?
Well, as an astrophotographer myself and representing a great many friends, both in the Madison Astronomical Society and other nearby astronomical societies, there are a lot of astrophotographers out there who are doing spectacular work. Most of them, I would say, would salivate to hear the comment of the caller just made, because opportunities to exhibit your work in galleries doesn't come by a lot. There are a lot more photographers out there than there are places to exhibit photography. So if the caller has ideas of places that may be willing to host some exhibits like that, I could definitely put him in touch with some photographers who would love to see their work hanging on a wall someplace with people oohing and aahing over it.
Yeah, so there you go. And John, how would Alan get a hold of you through the maybe through the Dark Sky Association, or
probably best through the Madison Astronomical Society. If you just Google Madison Astronomical Society, our link will be the first one that comes up. I am not currently an officer of the club, but if you send an email to the Madison Astronomical Society and reference John, I'm probably the one that email would go to.
Okay. So, Alan, there you go. Maybe an opportunity there. It sounds like there would be one for sure. Thank you again for your call. Ron in La Crosse, let's go to you next. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I heard recently that there's going to be a solar eclipse this month, and that most of it probably will be visible in the western states, maybe not here in Wisconsin by very much. So I just wonder what your guests would know about that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks a lot, Ron. Jim, I know, I'm sure you know about those.
Yeah, that's right. There are two solar, not this month, but there are two solar eclipses this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, no solar eclipses this month. But we do have two nice solar eclipses this year. We basically have two nice solar eclipses and two crummy lunar eclipses, which is sort of a flip from last year. Last year, we had two really nice total lunar eclipses and two crummy solar eclipses. So, good year for solar eclipses. The one in April will not be visible in the U.S., though. You have to be out in the South Pacific to see that. But that's going to be a marginal total annular eclipse. So there'll probably be cruise opportunities, and you'll have to be out there sort of in Indonesia from the Indian Ocean into the South Pacific to see that one. The good one for the U.S. is in October, October 14th. And that will be crossing from sort of the Pacific Northwest and then across Texas and then down over the Yucatan, Panama, along through there. In fact, it's maximum down there in around like Costa Rica or thereabouts. Now, that will be, though, an annular eclipse, not a total solar eclipse. When the total eclipse, when the moon completely blocks the disk of the sun, then we see the solar corona. And those are the famous pictures that you see of totality, and the corona is only visible then. But if there's a what's called a central eclipse, where they line up center to center, but if the moon is a little bit too far away, then it can't completely cover the disk of the sun. So there'll be a ring of sunlight.
Okay.
So we won't see the corona. And in fact, to observe an eclipse like that, you keep your eclipse glasses on the whole time because you're looking directly at the sun at all times. So we see a ring of sunlight, which is called Latin for ring is annulus. So it's called an annular eclipse. That's the ring of sunlight. So those are fun and very interesting too for a lot of reasons. But this one will be annular, not total on 14th of October.
When was the last total? I remember on being on campus.
Last total in Madison? I mean, it was.
Wasn't there one?
Poof. Well, we've had a number of partials. I'm not sure when. It's been many, many years since the last total eclipse would have been visible in Madison.
Okay, well,
but we've had
neither
some,
here nor there.
We've had some pretty close ones.
We've had some ones that were really close. I know in somewhat recent times.
We should probably mention that if somebody wants to know more about these eclipses, there are plenty of good websites for looking these things up, with detailed maps and things like that. One of them is called eclipsewise.com. There's another one, Mr. Eclipse.com. Mr. Eclipse is Fred Espenek, who did eclipse calculations for NASA for many, many years, and he runs these websites now. Either one of those are excellent places to start looking for eclipse information. Look up the 14th of October this year, annular eclipse, and you'll see a map of exactly where the path will be. It'll be partial here in Madison. We would have to drive. Probably the closest would be Texas or something along that line to be in the path of that eclipse.
Email, Jill wonders if you can take a good photo of the sky with a smartphone. And John, can you do that? How do you take a good smartphone sky photo? Let's put it that way.
Well, smartphone cameras have come a long way in the last, several years, and have revolutionized photography in many ways. One thing that is still very challenging, though, is nighttime photography with those cameras, including night sky. It is marginally possible to do it, but it's something that I don't personally recommend yet because smartphones in many ways are just not equipped to do it. One of the things you really need to do to take photos of the nighttime sky is you need to have your camera immobilized. So you need to use a tripod or something like that because the exposures are several seconds long. If you can do that, there are some apps out there that will take control of your phone's camera and allow you to do longer exposure, allow you to do some other processing things in the camera that will result in pretty decent shots. But just using like the iPhone camera app that most people use to take pictures of birthday parties and things like that probably will not do the trick. You're going to need to get an app. You might need to pay a few bucks for it. There might be some free ones out there. But for my money, the best opportunities for doing, like landscape photography with maybe a nice, forest scene with the starry sky above, you're going to need to use a real camera where you can really control the shutter speed and things like that. So smartphones are coming along, but in my opinion, they're not quite there yet.
With a new app or another app, what would you call that if you were searching for one? Just say an app that allows for longer exposure?
Yeah, I'd go to the app store and search for apps that, use keywords like astrophotography, astronomy, sky photography, something like that. There are probably dozens of them out there, some better, some worse. But if you dedicate yourself to a search like that, in other words, spend more than a minute or two on it, you're probably going to find a couple of reasonable options that would allow you to get some pretty satisfying results.
And somebody posted a shot of the, I think it's the moon. It almost looks like a portrait, which nobody can see. So why am I describing
it? So John mentioned mounting the phone to keep it steady. And there are some little fairly inexpensive devices out there now that will, they're actually intended for DSLRs what we might call more of a real camera, but you can mount a smartphone on these things, and they rotate with the sky, so it's basically a clock drive for your camera. And so when you're doing long exposures, if you just aim your camera in one direction and just keep the shutter open for more than a few seconds, really open for a minute or whatever, then you'll get trails from the stars moving. But there are some fairly inexpensive things intended to mount your camera, and it would work for a smartphone too, that will rotate with the sky so that you can do longer exposures. You're still limited in terms of the smartphone limitations of very small lenses, very slow speeds and things. But that's another development that people have been using. Fairly inexpensive for astrophotography these days.
Well, and you know, they seem to get the camera capabilities just seem to get better every year on those smartphones.
Yeah, there are add-on lenses and things you can also get for your smartphones. I'm not sure how effective they are, but the fundamental thing is you've got to collect a lot of light. You're looking at the dark sky. You need to collect a lot of light. A smartphone lens is just a tiny little thing, and a real camera lens
is a big thing.
Collects a lot of light, comparatively speaking. So, they're severely limited.
One thing that I would add, Larry, you mentioned a picture of the moon. Jim and I have both experienced this at star parties we've done over the last maybe 10 years or so since the smartphone revolution, is people will look through our telescopes pointed, for instance, at the moon, looking at craters and, you know, the detail that you can see. And a lot of people will just take out their phone and aim their little tiny iPhone camera through the eyepiece of our telescopes and get shockingly great pictures of the moon, to the extent that now people have made little plastic adapters that you can clamp onto your telescope that will hold a camera's aperture, the little camera lens, right up to the eyepiece. And the quality of photographs for bright objects like the moon and the planets is really shockingly good. People love doing that when we set up our telescopes at star parties.
Takes a steady hand, but yeah, it's good. can be good.
That's great. We had a listener emailed wondering about the green comet that was mentioned on the news. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be visible in Wisconsin this month?
The answer is yes. It's actually technically visible. It's in our sky, but it's setting so soon after the sun now. It goes down in the evening twilight shortly after the sun. But that's going to change rapidly in just the next couple of weeks. It's moving roughly northward. And we'll get higher in the sky in the evenings over in the west. By about the last week of January, it's going to be almost due north up near the Little Dipper, and the brightness is increasing. It's already a binocular. I haven't seen it myself yet, but it's already visible in binoculars. By the end of the month, it should be visible, should be much brighter and visible in binoculars. It's very hard to predict how the brightness of comets will vary, so nobody knows whether this will really brighten up a lot. But the current predictions are suggesting that it might reach naked eye visibility, which still means, for most of us, still means it's a binocular object, but it might be technically visible if you have really good eyes in a really dark sky.
Really good eyes.
But looking north, they'll be finding charts available on the web and that sort of thing. But if you scan around around the Little Dipper in the last week of this month and very early February, might just be able to pick that thing out.
Susan in Coon Valley called but couldn't stay with us. She was she likes to stargaze. But light, of course, as we talked about earlier in the show, has become a problem in most of the, many, many places. But just wonders, where are the best places around the country for someone looking for very dark skies?
Where's the caller from?
Coon Valley, Wisconsin. But sounds like Susan would be willing to travel. I mean, if it was me, some of the best I've ever had was in the middle of the Shawamigan National Forest.
There are some dark skies in northern Wisconsin, but John has made a study of this and traveled to a number of really dark sites, so I'll defer to him on that.
Yeah, John?
Yeah, I would recommend to Susan that, state parks, national parks tend to be good places. Most of our national park system also has dedicated night sky programming. They've really embraced the fact that their they're in very dark places, you know, by definition. But apart from the state parks, national forest ground, things like that, there are some tools on the internet that, Susan could use. And I would recommend that she Google the terms dark site finder or dark sky finder. There are a number of tools that will come up that basically amount to maps, like Google Maps, and that you can overlay, you know, a color coding that will show you the degree of light pollution. So over cities or near cities that would obviously be very bright and you know, not very good stargazing. But the color coding on the map will direct you toward the darkest skies in your area or the darkest skies in the country if you're willing to do a little bit of traveling to get to them. As Jim mentioned, I've done some extensive road tripping over the last several years and have made a little bit of a hobby of investigating and photographing some of those areas. So I have some favorites, but it depends on, you know, where you want to go, how willing you are to rough it, because there aren't going to be any high-rise hotels nearby in most of these really dark places, but they're findable.
Tense.
And if I'm not mistaken, John, aren't you going to be speaking on this topic at Space Place in the near future?
We are going to be talking, I think that's June, Jim. We're going to be talking about,
Yep, there it is. I just looked it up. Yeah, June 13th. John will be talking about this topic at Space Place on the evening of June 13th. So if you want to hear John and be able to ask questions about this sort of thing, that would be something to mark on your calendar.
And, you know, the Space Place site, you know, if I type in UW Space Place, it just comes up for me. But what's the proper?
It's pretty easy to find. Well, we're spaceplace.wisc.edu, but you can also just find us at spaceplace.org. It'll go right to it.
Spaceplace.org. Well, Susie and Menasha, I'm sorry we're not going to be able to get to you. She had a question about dark skies in Wisconsin and Florida, or a comment about them. But maybe for another time. In the meantime, Jim, John, thank you both very much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Pleasure as always.
You're welcome. Yep, thank you.
We'll do it again. Jim Lattice is director of the University of Wisconsin Space Place, a faculty associate in astronomy at UW-Madison. John Rummel is a longtime, lifelong, actually, amateur astronomer and photographer, longtime member and past president of the Madison Astronomical Society, and also a member of the International Dark Sky Association. And as we heard, you know, he's an activist for smart lighting and protecting the night. Well, I tell you what, we always have things coming up. You know, it's one day after the other and one program, right? After the other. And tomorrow, we are going to talk about remodeling your home. And we'll also cover how to improve your house's energy efficiency. That's tomorrow at 11. But in the meantime, hope you stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.